Welcome back to Red Ice Radio. Good to have you here. The websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com is where we have more for you. We come to you three times per week with a focus on all the interesting topics that simply are too important to ignore. Today we're going to go back on the Viking Trail once again. We have with us Robert Ferguson. He's one of the world's leading scholars in Scandinavian studies. After studying in London under Peter Foote, co-author of the classic Viking Achievement, he emigrated to Norway in 1984. At the invitation of the Norwegian government, he has lectured on aspects of Norwegian and Scandinavian history and culture at embassies, universities, and other cultural venues around the world. Today, we're going to discuss his book, The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings. Hi, Robert. Nice to speak with you today. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much. Nice to be invited.
Excellent. This is always a subject that's close to my heart, of course. It's my backyard, my territory, and I always love to speak about the Vikings. How did you get interested in this topic, and why did you want to write the book, Robert?
Well, I became interested in the Vikings, seriously interested in them, when I came across a short saga called the Saga of Hallfred Vandræðaskáld. It's in English, it's called the Saga of Hallfred, the Troublesome Poet. It's a very short saga, but it's unique in that this poet, this Skaldic poet, Hallfred, it's one of the very few times in Skaldic poetry that a poet isn't just praising his lord and going through a lot of formulaic historical recording of the great deeds of the lord. He's actually written some very personal, or not written, you know, composed some very personal stuff about what trouble he had when his mentors, his masters, his Olaf Tryggvason, Olaf Haraldsson, when they converted to Christianity and demanded that all their followers converted to Christianity too. Of course, this uniquely in Skaldic literature, this he expresses some of the distress and discomfort this enforced conversion caused him. And I was so fascinated by that whole idea of the syncretic period, the period of conversion from a time of revenge as being the great virtue to a time of forgiveness. You know, these are completely polar opposite qualities and virtues. And I became so preoccupied by it that I decided to write a novel. So I wrote and published a novel based on the saga of Hallfred. And I began doing, just as background research for this novel, which was, I wrote this about 10 or 12 years ago. I just began researching the Viking period, and I got so deeply into it that the next logical step seemed to be a Viking history.
Well, there you go. The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings. We'll obviously get more into the meat of the book and all this. And I want to ask you more about the sources later. There's so many things to discuss here, of course, but let's just kind of cover some of the bases first. Let's talk about the word, the etymology. What does Viking mean?
Well, it's again, this is one of these areas where there's no black and white answer to this. It's not even certain that it's a Scandinavian word. You know, you find it in some old English poetry from before the start of the Viking period. Viking us, che Viking us, sea Vikings. It appears to mean just basically seamen, sailors. But the word Viking itself, there's three main theories, I think. One is that it derives from an Old Norse word, vikja, which means to travel from place to place, which will just reflect the fact that the Vikings were wanderers and travelers, that they weren't the stay-at-home Scandinavians, they were the Scandinavians who were out traveling. Another theory is that it derives from the Latin word vicus, which means camp. I don't think that's personally a particularly good theory. My personal favorite is the theory that holds that it's based on the fact that this bay, the Vik, which is what people call still to this day, basically, the area, the southeast corner of Norway, the whole of the Oslofjord, that's the most frequently mentioned body of water in all saga literature, the Vik. And it may have simply derived from that these were men who frequented this bay, Vikingi. So I think that's the best guess, really, at why they're called Vikings. But it's one of those areas where there is no clear cut and dried answer.
Do you know if this Vik goes all the way down to, you know, Bohus? We have the west coast of Sweden right there, and I think that they used to be in Norwegian ownership, if we can call it that, for a long time. Is that right?
Well, in the very beginning, I think, all the evidence for when records start, like, for example, when written records start, which of course are Christian records, like the Royal Frankish Annals and so on, most of that area seems to be under Danish domination.
Interesting.
Most of southeast Norway, the southeast corner of Norway, Østfold, Vestfold, and the Bohuslän and so on, and Skåne, was all part of Denmark.
Yeah, that I know, definitely down south there.
Yeah. But the term Vik is simply this term that crops up in the sagas in that respect. You know,
definitely.
These things are never specific. You know, they didn't have maps. They didn't write geographies and histories.
Exactly. And as we know, a lot of these words can mean a lot of different things as well, right? They have dual meanings and triple meanings and whatnot. But yeah.
Sure.
So when should we say then that the Viking Age begins? There's obviously a lot of debates about this too, but I mean officially we look at Lindisfarne and all this. Where do we begin in your view?
Well, I think we do have this. We like to have things cut and dried, and we do tend to, most people tend to begin it with Lindisfarne in 793, but there are largely, I think, because it was an attack on a religious institution. It was an attack on a monastery. I mean, in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle 4 years earlier, there's this incident down in Portland, way down on the south coast of England, where a ship, probably Danish or Norwegian, landed, and they got into some kind of argument with the local officials, killed two or three of them, and that was, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the first time a ship of the Northmen arrived on these shores. But there is no further reference to any churches being burnt or any monks. So people tend not to include that as being, for example, the start of the Viking Age. I mean, as you probably know, of course, the Viking Age, these names and labels are later constructions. I mean, the Vikings didn't know they were living through the Viking Age. It's a subdivision which arose in the wake of that. I think his name was Thompson, a Dane in the early 19th century, who was the first to begin with this tripart division of history into a stone, a bronze, and an iron age. And the Viking Age would be a late part of the iron age. I think in Sweden you have the Vendel period.
Yeah.
We don't have that in British history. I think we probably miss it. It's a useful period to have, I think. We go straight into the Viking period, the Viking Age. But in terms of histories and so on, I think, yes, that's when it begins, 793. It's convenient, and we can't be any more specific. I mean, I do think that perhaps for two or three centuries before that, there was communication across the North Sea, peaceful communication, probably trading and so on. There's that odd, for example, the Sutton Hoo burial, which bears a lot of resemblances to the stuff that was found there to stuff from the Vendel period found in Sweden.
Yeah.
So there is a connection of some sort there. But I think as long as everything was peaceful, it's like the news now. It's not interesting. They don't note it. It's only when things turn bad that they start to note it down, and they start to turn it into news, if you like.
Yeah.
I think 793 is the logical place to start it.
To begin, exactly, yeah. But exactly, just as you say, though, it's a long string of connected events, and nothing is separated like that in history.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I sent you one of those links as well, but there was a recent, fairly recent find in Estonia, in the island of Salme, which is believed to be around, you know, the year 600. And, of course, if you look at some of the helmets and swords from the Vendel era, you see, you know, it's so similar. Everything, it's right there. The people have been there. The development of the armor and their art and everything is probably very much similar several hundred years before these raids start, right?
Yeah. Although I do think probably also maybe we'll talk about it later, but the ships, you know, the advent of sail, the sail on the longship was a great turning point, and a great enabling point in kicking the Viking Age off, if you like.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to get into more, of course, talking about some of the things that people, that the word conjures up and all that. But how do you think this, that Viking Reef, we can call it that then, if that means to travel or to go out and do things, and of course we have the raids and all this associated with that, but do you know if that was viewed differently, let's say, in Norse society prior to the when these attacks started in the late 700s?
No, and I don't think we can know. I mean, we have nothing written from that period. You know, we have we just don't have any record of how that sort of thing was viewed. You know, we just don't get that kind of information. So I can't really say anything about that, how it was viewed. I have nothing to say on that, really.
Sure, no problem. So what do you think was the likely reason then behind the drastic change here, that all of a sudden a shift occurs, something happens, we have what looks like fairly peaceful relations possibly between North European peoples or what have you, and then this tremendous shift takes place? What happens? Mm.
Well, I think there are a number of theories about this, but let me start straight off with the theory that has gained a lot of popularity in recent years among scholars. It was not popular at all during the 20th century historians, who increasingly, I think, tried to promote the idea of traders rather than raiders. They tried to invert the idea that this was essentially a kind of outburst of violence. And I think it's partly because, I mean, it's not my theory, but it's a resurrected theory. It was first mentioned by Edward Gibbon, the English historian, and taken up later by H.G. Wells. And that relates the outbreak of the Viking Age to things not that happened within Scandinavia, such as land hunger or poverty or various kind of sociological explanations, but rather to the rise of Charlemagne and the rise of the Frankish Empire and the expansionist nature of that rise, the missionary imperative under which Charlemagne was operating, which led him, for example, to forcibly try to convert the Saxons, who were the buffer tribe between his empire and the Danes up on the Jutland Peninsula. And this was something that went on, let's say, for about something like 20 years. Historically, there's records of this in the Royal Frankish Annals, 20 years before Lindisfarne. Constant references to his attempts to completely subjugate and subdue the Saxons and so on, to actually annihilate heathen Saxon culture. And I think that he did this brutally and very successfully, and I think that this, in many ways, and this requires a kind of empathic act on our part to put ourselves in the state of mind and position of the Danes, the Swedes, and the Norwegians, to have this going on your own back doorstep. This amazingly powerful emperor, who appears to be dedicated to expanding his empire in the name of Christianity, and I think in some ways, I think they must have. Why it broke out was this increased fear that their own cultures were being threatened.
Right.
And I think that is a theory that is. I know historians in the last century did not really have any empathic understanding of that aspect of it, but I think increasingly, as we saw things like what happened in the former Yugoslavia, what happened in Rwanda, it sort of came back into the center of attention, this idea that the ethnic and cultural differences could lead to the most ferocious tensions and warfares between people.
When cultures clash and when different people with different values come close together in proximity, you get interesting things happen, right?
Yes, you do, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So can you tell us more about the conflict here between Charlemagne and the Saxons? I mean, we have the massacre at Verdun and the destruction of Irminsul, correct?
Yes. I mean, those are the two standout events, if you like. And sort of woven around those are a series of battles and which, when you read the Royal Frankish Annals, which are the best documentation for that period, it seems fairly obvious to me that it is a religious, it's a cultural struggle. And the Saxons never gave up. Their named leader was a man named Widukind. And he was married to a sister or a daughter of the Danish king in the 770s. I think he would cross the border and seek refuge with the Danes during lulls in fighting, or if he felt himself particularly harassed by Charlemagne. So in that way, the Danes sort of got involved in it already in the 770s, 780s. But this, the standout event, and in many ways, the sort of Sarajevo incident of the Viking Age, in many ways for me, is that the massacre at Verden on the River Assa, where, and this is the Franks themselves are the source of this, so it's not some kind of propaganda, that 4,500 unarmed Saxon captives were forcibly baptized and then beheaded. I mean, this is one of the most appalling massacres in recorded history, and it's very easy to understand that something as grotesque and huge as that would send shockwaves up through the Jutland Peninsula and beyond into the Danish sphere of influence, into Skåne, into Østfold and Vestfold in Norway. And really, actually, as a kind of wake-up call, now look, this is going to turn out very, very badly for us. What are we going to do? Of course, they couldn't put an army in the field against probably the mightiest emperor the world has ever seen, Charlemagne. So they had to come up with something.
Yeah.
And the outbreak of the Viking Age is more or less what they came up with, I think.
Well, that's interesting. So we don't have a scenario where we have very disconnected Germanic tribes. They are closely related in communication. As you say, there are even intermarriage between them. So the word would have spread fairly quick here, I guess, right?
I think so, but again, I've thought about this. I mean, that massacre was, I think, 783. So, you know, if you're a skeptic about this theory, you might say, well, what, 10 years? But I think that things moved a lot slower then. I mean, communication, yes, but the actual real nature, but it's not like we watch the news and we can see, for example, 9/11. We get it straight away. I mean, you may imagine how long it would take for the news of 9/11 and the enormity of it and the actual real nature of it to have reached us without telecommunications. I'm not too dismayed by the fact that there's a gap of time. You know, historically speaking, that's just 5 minutes, really, that 10 years. So I do think, when you've got a massacre of that size, and you have the information, like, why they did it, you know, why this massacre was carried out in the name of a new religion, and the one aspect of that religion was that it did not tolerate non-believers. Conversion was a forcible thing. You had to be a Christian, according to that religion. So that it was completely a crux moment. You know, I think it's quite possible they thought, if we don't do something, we will simply be annihilated. We will be wiped out, culturally speaking, the way the Saxons have been.
Yeah, I mean, we might be talking about that 10-year gap there of both preparation but also strategy and thinking about what to do, because I've been thinking about this. It's strange. If the threat was coming from the south, right, with the Franks and whatnot, if the fight was with them, why go over to the British Isles and attack Lindisfarne, which is a completely different people, even, right?
Yeah. Again, this is a point where I think we have to try to exercise some empathy and almost think of it. I mean, I think in the sense of, you know, we'll get into this a bit later, but I think there's in a way that the Viking Age has two identities. It has the identity at the outbreak of it, which is these raids on the, which we'll talk about in a moment, but it's across the whole of Northern Britain and the north of Ireland too. It has that aspect to it. But then later on, in the middle of the 9th century, the Great Heathen Army, it takes on a different aspect. But let's stick for the time being to the outbreak of it. And my theory is, and I'm not alone in this, people like Bjørn Miele, Norwegian archaeologist and so on, it's a theory that's attracted increasing popularity, is that what we're talking about is some kind of asymmetrical warfare, which is to say that when they attacked Lindisfarne, Iona, Skye, all these isolated monasteries around the upper rim of the British Isles, it wasn't just like robbing a bank or something. The fact that these were religious institutions, and Lindisfarne was the almost the centre of the holiest place in Northern Europe. It was done almost as a terrorist attack on a soft target.
Ah.
And, of course, there was wealth there, and this became increasingly important when they realized the sort of wealth that was kept in monasteries. But I think that one of the major impulses was that they wanted to do great damage and harm to Christianity. They wanted to frighten the Franks. They wanted to frighten Charlemagne away from any thought of putting a fleet up, or however he would have done it, to try to move up and Christianize Scandinavia. It's in exactly the same way as terrorists do now, as a way of a very small force that can possibly meet a larger force in the field face to face in battle, resorts to this kind of symbolic violence, like for example 9/11, the symbolic violence, however awful it was symbolic. There was no way that they could have followed it up.
Guerrilla warfare kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I think it was the only option they had to show that they cared a lot. They did not want to be converted. They were quite happy with what they had, their own culture. They did not want to share the fate of the Saxons.
Yep.
So that was basically the only option they had, I think.
So this could be the side note of sorts, but also if we think about the wealth accumulation that was sought during these raids as well, it's very possible that this was to be used to, let's say, build up, you know, the armies, the weaponries, with trade with other. I mean, as we know, the Volga trade route and all these things, they led far down into, yeah, possibly even down to Persia, right? So we have a trade with the Arab world, and there might be wealth that was sought to be attracted from here, and technology and weaponry and things like that, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And at the same, and also, I mean, the British Isles was England, because it wasn't England then, it was just five or six separate kingdoms. But it was a wealthy country too. Britain was very wealthy. So you already had, I think, Arab silver known of and making its presence felt in Gotland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway. When you're talking about the motives, really, it's a kind of cocktail of motives. It's all sorts of things at once. You know, I don't want to fall into the trap of saying this and no other was the reason.
There
were
many,
many.
Yeah.
But I do want to also, every time I read these descriptions of the attacks on the monasteries and also off the coast of France, for example, and you read or for example, Skye, or was it Iona, I think, where they killed all 68 of the monks. And you think, well, why did they need to do that if they were just after gold? There's a kind of overkill about it. There's a kind of almost psychopathic hatred and a far too much violence if it's just about robbery.
Yeah.
And I think that we find that these are the kind of the dark echoes of the way Charlemagne treated the Saxons. You know, that this is, the gloves are off. Anything goes now.
Well, you said earlier, I guess, as a way of distinguishing the Viking period or what they had, their traditions, let's call them Asatru for now to make it easy in that regard, and then when Christianity came in, distinguish them as time of forgiveness versus time of revenge. But if we then look at Charlemagne and what they brought, that wasn't much forgiveness in that, right? The conversion here came sometimes extremely violently in different times in different parts of the northern world, basically. So how do we explain this? Why were they so violent?
Why were the Christians so violent?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's because of the. I know these are such difficult things to talk about because. You might have the best intentions in the world, which is what you get from Christianity, forgive your enemy and so on, but it's fantastically hard to actually do it in practice. I mean, Christianity was as much about an institution as it was about an ethical system, I think. There was also the missionary imperative, which some people, certainly in the 20th century, people thought of that as being very obviously progress, you know, from the many to the one, polytheism to monotheism. It seemed a kind of logical and modernizing step, we can say already in the early 20th century, people don't necessarily think that anymore. But I think at the time it was completely obvious that it was almost a kind of duty of a leader like Charlemagne to make sure that everybody became Christian, that everybody got the message, that everybody was part of the same institution. I mean, a lot of people refer to Charlemagne as the father of Europe, the father of the EU in a way, and it often struck me as I was working on the early part of that book in particular, that what we're looking at here was an early attempt to create a European Union on the basis of the fact that it's monocultural.
Yeah.
That everybody, and that as long as everybody has the same God, it's one less reason to go to war. It doesn't work out completely like that, in fact. It's the same sort of argument as people have about democracy. You know, that, well, if we both have, then we can't go to war because you say your God's right and I say mine's right.
Right.
So, I think that there's that element in it that we can't, being converted was really a kind of, it's really an admission of institutionalization. You accept the institutions of Christian culture with linear time and writing and all sorts of things like that. But of course, when you're down in the field and so on, of course, those early muscular so-called Christians were as brutal as anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Political strategy, centralization of power, etc. There's a lot of things here. We maybe go deeper into that later, but I want to ask you just a little bit more here about what you think happened here, specifically in Scandinavia when Christianity came in, because it seems to me in some parts, other parts of the Viking Empire, whatever we want to call that, we have the Rus, for example, the Varangians. They had one way of kind of converting, then something else happened over in England. But how do you think it was in Scandinavia themselves once Christianity came up there? I mean, I've heard horror stories of people being beheaded in front of their families due to the fact that they didn't want to convert to Christianity. What do you think happened?
I think it was extremely brutal. I mean, these are aspects of Snorri Sturluson, Hans King, which are there's no reason to suppose that he made that up. For example, if we're talking about Olaf Tryggvason in Norway, he was extremely brutal during the 5 years in which he tried, towards the end of the 10th century, the 5 years in which he tried to impose Christianity. It's all sorts of tortures. But it did happen very piecemeal. I mean, in Sweden, you had Ansgard, middle of the 9th century. He had some success with his Christian mission and so on. But it was very piecemeal, very dotted about. And I think that when it finally happened, and it happened in a sort of staggered way across Scandinavia, I think that, you know, the salient point is that it was always their own kings who introduced it. They would not accept conversion from foreign imported missionaries.
Right.
I think that's very significant. You know, once people were prepared to accept it from their own kings, but and then, of course, we're back to this institutionalization thing. They were accepting the institution. They probably didn't give a damn about the ethical content of Christianity. It was just what the king wanted, and okay, we'll do it. Do you see I don't think that there was any, I don't think a priest had any real chance of converting them. You know, it was
right.
Just the power of the Christian king, and the power of the... Of Harald Bluetooth, and it's the power of Olaf Tryggvason and Olaf Haraldsson, and Sweden is a slightly special case, as you know, because I call in the book the last bastion of heathendom.
Yeah,
I think it held on there much longer than elsewhere.
That's right. The great heathen at Uppsala stood up till about 1080, it's believed, I guess. So if we can talk more about that later too. But so what do you think was some of the incentives of the kings here? Did they go, when they were out and about, they got, let's say, influenced by others or enticed by what could be gained if they converted to Christianity or something?
Yes, I think so. I think it was the modernization process. I think they saw all the great leaders south of them had converted to Christianity. I think there's also an element in the whole idea of monotheism that appealed to kings, that of course it would lead to monarchy, you know, that they did not need to share the power with anybody else. It was that if things on earth mirrored things on heaven, then the king was the only one, the way God was the only one. I think that had a definite appeal. I wouldn't completely rule out either a sort of ethical appeal, the fact that, you know, people often can subscribe to an ideal knowing full well that it's almost impossible to live it out. Communism is a good example, for example, but people think it's worth starting, trying at least, you know. So there may be an element of that in it too. And in most cases, particularly as regards the Vikings in the 9th and 10th century, leaders like Guthrum in East Anglia or Rollo in Normandy, a condition of their acceptance into the kind of mainstream Northern European aristocracy was conversion. This would be a condition of the treaties, for example, the treaty that Guthrum signed with Alfred the Great in England. One of the conditions was that he convert to Christianity and take a Christian name, so he was called Athelstan after that. So it was always a condition. It was the way in which the Christians tried to deal, Christian rulers tried to deal with the Viking phenomenon. One of the things was, as we spoke of just a few months earlier, one of the things was that, well, if we have the same religion and believe in the same gods, that's one less reason for us to fight each other, to go to war against each other. So I think that that's the reason why many of the isolated incidents of conversion, like Guthrum in East Anglia and Rollo in Normandy, for example, that accounts for those conversions. When it comes to the actual kings, Olaf Tryggvason, Olaf Haraldsson, and it's so obscure in Sweden that it's hard to say really who brought it in. I mean, Sweden, possibly because it was, it hung on so resolutely to heathendom while everybody else had gone over to Christianity, and that's probably partly because of Sala was there. The Swedes never had a Saxo Grammaticus or a Snorri Sturluson to tell their early history. So we're, to an unusual degree, we're dependent on late sagas and that type of thing. So it's a little difficult to say who actually introduced it into Sweden. The impression you get from some of the later sagas is that it sort of came and went, and kings accepted Christianity and then went back on it and so on. But
yeah, at least as far as we know, we didn't have a Snorri or someone like that. We have, of course, a lot of fires in Sweden, not the least the Tre Kronor Castle, the Three Crowns in Stockholm, I think was burned in 1697. And during that time, it was actually a lot of studies that was going on, and I've heard rumors that a lot of material actually was gone and burnt up in that fire that didn't have time to be studied. But what can we know, right? That's just speculation at this point, you know. But
Yes, it's possible. Of course it's possible, yeah. Yeah, and of course Sweden has those vast number of rune stones compared to Norway and Denmark, which is in terms of sources and so on, which we may talk about later. But in terms of completely reliable historical sources, you can't beat an inscribed rune stone. Yeah,
exactly. Now, so when Christianity comes in, and I just have to mention this, then ironically, even what the reasons were, if it was to create peace, of course it had to come in with war, and you had bloodshed in its name in order to impose this centralization and later what they maybe have sought to achieve with peace, etc. But what happened, there's a kind of an interperiod here, of course, when they both clash violently. And I know we're talking about several hundred years here. There's a vast geography that we can talk about, you know, so there's a lot of difficult to pinpoint one thing here. But is there anything else you can say to kind of paint us a picture of when heathens and Christians and these two faiths starting to collide with each other?
You mean collide in a violent way, or become?
Yeah, exactly. We can talk about the dual faith a little bit later, but the conflicts that occur when this happens. Is there any other major historical events here that we should underline?
I don't think so. You know, I think basically what we get from Snorri is the story of the struggle that, for example, Håkon the Good in Norway had, who tried to introduce Christianity. He was the one who was fostered at Athelstan's court in England. He was a son of Harald Finehair, who was fostered at the Christian court of Athelstan in England, and then went back to claim the throne in Norway and tried to introduce Christianity. And the Lord, the Earls, just said, no, we're not having it. And he gave way with a good grace, but there was tremendous resistance to it. But I don't know of any huge battles that were fought in the name of that kind of rearguard action for heathendom. Mm. I mean, there's so much in this area that perhaps there were. I don't know. Do you know of any?
No, I mean, I see the whole thing as a fight of sorts. I mean, the whole era is an era of resistance and conflict here, where they try to, you know, one wants to impose itself, one to try to preserve itself, you know. So,
I would say that, and this goes back really to what you said at the very beginning about Hallfred's saga. What fascinated me particularly when I very first began to get really interested in this was what happened in Iceland in 999 or 1000, depending on which record you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when Olaf Tryggvason was sending over a group of Christianized Icelandic chieftains and he had already taken hostages who were the sons of some of the leading heathen Goði or chieftains in Iceland. And at the summer old thing in 999, everything took place in one day. Olaf Tryggvason had given Gizur the White and one or two other chieftains, given them money, and said, more or less said, don't come back until you've converted the Icelanders. And I think there's no reason to suppose that the majority of Icelanders were almost certainly heathens. This was a minority, passionate minority of Christians. The law speaker, Þorgeir Ljósvetningur Goði, he was a heathen. What happened was that the League of the Christians, there was almost going to be a civil war. This is what fascinated me. It was almost going to be a civil war. This is all happening around the days of in late June, at the summer all thing. It's just, they're ready to kill each other and just destroy that little society. But they effect a compromise, and the leader of this little Christian mission, Gizur the White, gives the money to Thorgeir, the law speaker, and says, you decide. And he goes and lies down. He goes into, let's just say he lies down and meditates, thinks deeply about the problem all night. He gets up in the morning, he calls everybody to go to the law rock and hear what he has to say, and he announces that extraordinary decision that they shall all become Christian. And he gives a very good speech, which is actually quoted verbatim in Ari, saying that we must become Christians, because if we don't, a country divided cannot stand. This is, if you like, you know, this is not in any sense a kind of multicultural dream. This is very much expressing a belief in the idea that we must all have the same faiths and the same laws. Otherwise, we will be torn apart. And I think the people must have been astounded. But such was their faith in the law, such was their belief in the law and their respect for the law, that they simply went away and had themselves baptized. I think that story, it's almost my favorite story from the whole Viking period, and I can't understand why the rest of the world is not more fascinated by it, that it worked out okay. You know, it really was. It was really, they were just about to tear that little society apart, and that diplomatic man stood up and averted the disaster. And yet I do think that probably, I don't know, 70% of the Icelanders were nominally heathen at the time. It shows the very pragmatic nature of things in those days, I think. I mean, who's to say how much they really cared one way or the other, you know?
Well, exactly, and as we, you know, we saw a kind of a merger of a dual faith as well, and in some aspect they could keep some. I mean, case in point, look at these churches in Norway and how you know, how they kept that traditional style, probably, of how they used to look, right? But they still, now it's a Christian temple, but you know, I see, even if we examine the roots of Christianity itself, and particularly at this time when you've had, you know, just a few, well, maybe 500 years earlier, you've had a lot of ecumenical councils by the Roman Catholic Church, Reformation, etc. But those who have been looking at the roots of the Roman Catholic faith knows that there are many similarities with previous belief systems and more pagan systems as well. So there is that relationship still between there, which is, if we today, for example, we might think about, you know, Protestantism or, you know, Lutheranism or something like that, which would be very, it was a different Christianity back then too, correct?
Yeah. And of course, when you have it, when the most powerful emperor in the world is a Christian, that's a very, very good advertisement for it as a system, as an institution, I think, you know. Just power, just the equation with power.
Does any of this imply as well that their own traditions couldn't help to keep them together? I mean, we know some things about their rites and their traditions and some of the things they did with, we could talk more about blut and, you know, sacrifice, some of these things, but I guess my main question would be, why do you think that Christianity stuck with the heathens? Why couldn't they hang on to their own traditions? Wasn't it strong enough?
Well, I think that's possible. That is one theory that people say, that it was moribund, that it was somehow dying, you know, that it was just a dying religion, and religions do die. Probably because of the overwhelming success of Christianity, this long, slow advance over the previous 600 years, moving northwards and westwards from Rome. Also, there's no real evidence that, in fact, there was, I think heathendom, there is no dogma, there is no book of heathendom. And I think if you go to Gotland, if you went to Mälaren, if you go to Jelling, if you went to Bodø in Norway, you would probably find different ways of being a heathen, different ways of dealing with the dead, different ways of getting married that they did not have, because they did not have the written word, in the sense that they didn't have the Bible, didn't have a Bible. They had no ultimate authority. They had no uniformizing document. So that, let's say, I mean, if it's very difficult to hold something together, if we're actually basically talking about, okay, they worship the same gods, but there's no uniformity of worship. It's different in all sorts of different places. It's harder to create a feeling of solidarity on behalf of that, I think. That it's harder to know what you're defending. You know, you could make concessions here and you wouldn't know if they were important or not. I mean, sometimes you read about that they cremated the dead. On the Volga, for example, that famous with the Rus Viking band on the Volga, that they cremated the dead, and then you've got the Oseberg mound where the two women were lying in bed as skeletons. There is no real uniformity, and I think the lack of uniformity, the lack of a dogma, of a kind of structure that was the same wherever you went in Scandinavia, necessarily meant that it did not have the kind of strength that enabled it to resist something that could present a uniform, unified front, such as Christianity could.
So it's, we understand it's for maybe strategic purposes as well, but as you say, the simplicity of the rites that come in with Christianity and probably in together with a written language versus maybe a more difficult outlined rite structure, perhaps nothing written down. Perhaps there were. We don't really know that, but we have the rune stones, of course, and that implies that there were, you know, alphabets and language used. We don't know if they wrote on birch parchments, which have withered away over time and was lost.
Wax boards is another one. I'm sure they used wax boards, but I would think in a very primitive way, like for short messages. Really, I don't think we can imagine that there was ever any kind of record of a record, for example, of dogma.
Right.
That could be sent between the different communities. I don't think. I think there was. They lived very isolated communities. I think it was almost. They were almost. Separate communities. Probably not a tremendous sense of community beyond the local community.
Right. So it's difficulty with pluralism. Christianity came in very simple. It's simplicity, and I guess to a certain extent, I guess we can see that in the modern world today as well. And look at the progression of Christianity itself, with from Catholicism to Protestantism, and now we're kind of in this Calvinist scientific age almost. But it's of sorts. It's if you allow me to use the word, it's a dumbing down, right? It's a simplification of everything, which makes it palatable and easy to adopt by everybody, right?
Well, that's true. You can get the same. I mean, if the ritual is the same everywhere, then it's much easier to control the ritual. You can, by introducing saints' days that have the same validity everywhere, then you can control time in a much more. You can control people's daily lives quite simply in a much more structured way with a heavily institutionalized Christianity.
So let's talk about one more point here before we end for the first segment. We're going to, of course, continue and talk more in the second. I have so many more questions for you here. But let's just address the issue of sacrifice and the blut as well. Did they sacrifice humans and animals every 9 years? And what has nine to do with all of this anyway?
Well, that's it. The 9 years is particularly associated, I think, with Uppsala and Leda in Denmark, the great festivals there. I think they did, according to Snorri, this is, I have no trouble accepting Snorri Sturluson on this, that in times of need, in times of distress, in times of shortages, they would sacrifice, they thought the gods were angry with them, and they would sacrifice to the gods. And there was this notion of sacral kingship that you sometimes read of a hierarchy of sacrifices, that if the crops are very bad and they start off with a sacrificing, give some fruit and it doesn't get any better, so they sacrifice an ox and then the final in this hierarchy of sacrifices, the last and most valuable sacrifice they could offer was the king, and there's several instances of that in Snorri Sturluson. So yes, I think they did sacrifice animals and human beings. And it's interesting, actually, apropos what happened in Iceland, was that when the heathens in 999 said that they were going to sacrifice, they were going to sacrifice to their gods, I don't think they carried out those sacrifices, but I think in connection with that discussion, I think the point was raised by some scholars that when we talk about human sacrifices, it's very often actually a form of capital punishment, that these people were considered criminals anyway, that they were, it was a way of, if you like, getting rid of undesirable members of society and simply sacrifice them to one of the gods who demanded a sacrifice. So I think there's no doubt, there's all sorts of finds spread across the Viking world that seriously indicate that there was, that human sacrifice went on, probably only in extremis, but that did happen. Yeah,
I think there's one difference, as far as I know here. One deviant aspect, if we look at who they sacrificed, there is a story coming from Snorri as well about Dumalde, right? The Swedish king. And what's interesting here, I think, as well, is that if we look at other sacrificial, if we can call them that, societies around the world, you know, from the Aztecs and the Incas and all that stuff, it seems like they captured, you know, other tribes' people and sacrificed them on the altar and whatnot. Here is a very different thing, where they take the highest personage that they have within their society and sacrifice them to, you know, turn something around. Maybe it's superstition, maybe it is something else, but they go for the very leader of their own society and sacrifice them. That's quite of a different thing, isn't it?
It is, you know, and it's also, I think this is, again, this is sacral kingship, which they did have. They believed that the king was, of course, priest as well. There were king priests before Christianity, and it would be the same person. And when they were sacrificing the king, it wasn't really to blame the king. It was like this was the most valuable thing they could give a god.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think that's why Dumalde, for example, was sacrificed.
Yeah, exactly. There's a great painting, by the way, by a Swedish painter, Carl Larsson, that is called Midvinterblut, which means midwinter.
You know, I've seen that. It's fabulous.
Yeah, it's really great. That's scene there. I'll link that up so people can look at that. But all right, let's take a short break here, Robert, but I do want to talk about your book a little bit more here first, and of course, where people can go to pick up copies. I know you have a lot of other titles. You write about a lot of different things. You can please feel free to mention some of your other titles as well, but give us your website so people know where to go.
Okay, it's www.robertferguson.org, robertferguson.org.
Very good. And, of course, The Hammer and the Cross, A New History of the Vikings. That is the book we're talking about. And we'll have the link up to Robert's website as well. So click through from ours. And, of course, take a look at some of the other books and novels he has there as well. Okay, Robert, we'll take a short break here, and then we'll be right back with more. Well, folks, ladies and gentlemen, we have more to discuss in the second hour with Robert Ferguson about the history of the Vikings. We will continue to focus on the sources, the runestones, the sagas, and the chronicles to correlate information about what really happened during these 300 to 400 tumultuous years. We will talk more about law in Viking society, honor and shame to maintain order and structure, cosmology and myths. We also discuss their achievements, how far they traveled, and some of their most extraordinary battles. We also talk about when the Viking Age ended, as this differs depending on where in the world you are and when the Vikings ceased to appear. We, of course, speak more about the burning of the great heathen temple at Uppsala and the Blut rituals every 9 years. Join us as we pick up after the break. Go to redicemembers.com and subscribe if you haven't already. It's only €5 per month. We have 3-month subscriptions all the way up to 2 years available. And, of course, you'll get full access to all our previous shows, over 900 programs as of right now. And you can also give a membership as a gift for the Yuletides, of course, a Christmas gift. So do take a look. Our next program is with UK archaeologist Martin Biddle. We are going to proceed on the Viking Trail. He is the gentleman who, together with his wife, discovered the Viking burials at Repton in England. We're going to talk about how the great heathen army used the Anglo-Saxon church as part of their defense wall. And we're going to speak more about the finds, the process, and of course speculate whether or not Ivar the Boneless, Ivar Ragnarsson, one of the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok, was buried in Repton, as we have some fascinating reports of a 9-foot-tall giant skeleton being found there. And Mr. Biddle did find some exceptionally large bones in the Viking mounds at Repton, so don't miss that one. Well, after that, we have Frank De Silva on Radio 314, Joaquin Flores on Red Ice Radio, and also following that, we have John Lash, Colin Liddell, and Andy Nowicki, Marion Vancourt, Dennis Fetcho, Jay Dreyer, Jeff Gates, and Laird Scranton. Join us at redicemembers.com for more. We'll be right back.